The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey friends, and welcome to Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. I am so privileged to be on the line with somebody that I've respected and that I've followed for a number of years. If you're a member of the group that loves the Orlando Magic, then you gotta love this guy. I'm talking to Pat Williams, the general manager of the Magic in the beginning and one of the partners that brought this great team to Orlando. I'm so thrilled, and this has given me all sorts of warm fuzzies, man, when I think back to the years that my son and I spent in that first arena and watched the Magic. And we are so grateful for you, Pat, and for all that you brought, the enthusiasm. I'm sure you've been called Mr. Enthusiasm more than once in your lifetime. Welcome to my program, Pat Williams.
Thank you, Mike. Good to visit with you. And look forward to our chat.
Yeah, as am I. I've really been anticipating this. You know, Pat, when most of us know you from your big work, as I mentioned, with the Orlando Magic, and we've seen things. I think one of those moments in sport history that will always go down is the expression that was caught on your face when the Magic won the top draft pick and was going to be able to draft Shaquille O'Neal. The look on your face, as they say, was golden. It was great. What was going on in your mind at that moment?
Well, we knew that there was a franchise-turning player in the draft. That's not true every year. It's not many years, frankly, but everybody knew Shaq was going to have an enormous impact on a team and the sport itself. So all the teams sitting there for the lottery were all just holding their breath, knowing that there were big stakes. And sure enough, our ping pong ball prevailed, and 1992 will always be remembered here as a huge turning point in the history of the franchise. That's when we won the lottery and Shaq arrived and started to put his stamp on this franchise.
Well, I tell you, that was an exciting moment, I am sure, and memorable for me. The look on your face again was a little bit of a mixture of surprise and maybe shock that it was actually coming our way, and I'm grateful that it did, and it brought many fun years for the Orlando Magic. Before we talk more about the Magic and basketball, I would love if you could, Pat, to kind of give us a little bit of a sketch of your life growing up, where you grew up. What kind of family upbringing did you have? Was it a church upbringing? Let us know those things, if you will, sir.
Well, I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. My dad was a high school history teacher and a baseball coach. I grew up in a very sports-oriented family, and I fell in love with athletics and sports when I was very young. That allowed me to play all the sports in high school. Baseball was my best sport. I went to Wake Forest to play ball there and got my degree, caught for the baseball team for four seasons. Upon graduation in June of 1962, I got an opportunity to go into pro baseball. I signed with the Phillies and spent 2 years as a minor league catcher in their farm system. The Phillies saw something in me that would be better suited for the front office than behind the plate as a catcher. And they moved me into the front office end of baseball. I spent 5 years helping to run minor league ball clubs for the Phillies in their farm system. And then at the age of 28, seemingly out of a clear blue sky, Dr. Jack Ramsey called and offered me a job with the 76ers. I took it. And that started a 51-year career in the National Basketball Association, including almost 35 years here in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be kind of a thumbnail sketch. There's a lot more to it than that, but That's an overview.
I tell you what, baseball was very big for you, and I know that that had to be an amazingly difficult job at that level, being a catcher. Now, number one, my knees have always been bad, Pat. I could never do what you did back in that time. But how was that, catching those major league balls that were coming in at that speed? What was that like?
Well, Mike, you get used to it. You know, catchers are a different breed. They're kind of gamers and grinders and grunters, you know, putting on that equipment and in the heat of the day many times. But to be a catcher, you've got to love it. You got to love the involvement. Every pitch, there's something to be thinking about. So that was a big part of my life. I learned a great deal about leadership through my baseball days.
Mm-hmm.
The catchers have kind of their own society. They're members of an exclusive club.
They're sitting right under a big, heavy bat that is swung by a very strong ball player, and that in itself would cause most people to have a bit of pause about the danger about that. But I'm grateful for catchers, and it sounds like you had a wonderful run playing 4 years of college ball, and all of that speaks to the fact that you were indeed, my friend, a skilled ball player to play at that level. And I know that that was an exciting time. Tell us about what church life was like for you as a young man.
Well, I grew up in a church-oriented family. My mother took me every weekend to Westminster Presbyterian Church in Wilmington, Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was ever a time that I did not believe in God, but believe in our country. Believe in the value of family. You know, that's how I was raised. But as far as a personal relationship with a living Savior and a life commitment to Jesus Christ, that wasn't there. I didn't fully grasp the significance of that. And so through my high school days and my college days, I was never off on a deep end. I was certainly far from a degenerate. I was not a drinker, a smoker, you know, tried to live a good life. But it wasn't until I was 27 years old in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that the claims of Christ were presented to me in a very clear manner. And I had tried just about everything else to try and find peace and security and fulfillment in life. And it was not until I realized that the only way that was going to happen was to commit my life to Christ. And I did that in February of 1968, 54 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how my faith walk really began in earnest.
Mm. That's a wonderful story. And to realize that sometimes it's later in life that we find that. I had a guy one time, Pat, that said, God is never early, but he's never late either. He's always right on time. And how true that is. God is he's never early, but he's never late. And it's just amazing the timing for you that you found the Lord and that it stuck in such a way that it was the real deal. Grateful for and how you're living your life, my friend. Thank you so much for that and for sharing that with us. That's very meaningful to hear people's testimony. You said that was in South Carolina. Tell us some of the routes along your life, if you will.
Well, I was born in Philadelphia, raised in Wilmington, Delaware. Went to college at Wake Forest in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Played ball in Miami in the summer of 62. Then went to Bloomington, Indiana to start work on my master's degree. Back to Miami again, and then to Spartanburg, South Carolina, where I ran the Phillies Farm Club for 4 years, then to Philadelphia with the Sixers for a year, then to Chicago with the Bulls for four, then to Atlanta for one with the Atlanta Hawks, back to Philadelphia for 12 years, and then to Orlando for 35 years.
Yeah, you've been here longer than any one spot then.
By far.
Yes.
Once we got here, it was obvious we weren't going anywhere. Once you get a good taste of Orlando in your system, there's no other place to live.
So that would
take you, that takes me from birth to almost age 81.
Oh, now wait a minute. You're not saying you are 81, right? No way, right?
I'll be 81 on May 3rd.
No way. That is amazing. Even for those of us that have been around that long, you are the best 81 I've seen in years, my friend. That is tremendous. I love that. I'm talking to Pat Williams today, and coming up in just a moment, we're going to find out a lot more about some of those events that he talked about when he was with the NBA and those years that he spent up in the 76ers. I tell you what, this was a golden era of basketball that Pat has been able to be a part of. And we'll return with him coming up in just a moment right here on The Shepherd. 'Tis a privilege I have today to be on the line with Pat Williams. And he is the man that brought the Orlando Magic to town. And he's been in professional sports for a great portion of his life. And so thankful for the fact that he has found a home in Central Florida. And I completely agree with you, Pat. Once you have a taste of the beautiful weather in Central Florida, the wonderful people, this is indeed one of the nicest places to be around. And grateful that you are here and my family, again, the beneficiaries of your great vision. You know, we talked about the fact that you spent all these years in NBA, and that's really where it happened for you. Tell us a little bit about what those early years in the NBA, because you would have been involved in them in the years leading up to what most people would consider to be the height of the whole NBA experience in the 90s with Michael Jordan and all of the great games that were going on then. Of course, the Orlando Magic, you were already in Orlando at that time. But go back to the 76ers days and tell us what it was like to see the NBA in its development.
Well, I had spent the 1 year in Philadelphia, 68-69 season, then went to Chicago for four. Back then, the NBA, it was still a very young league. Mm-hmm. Comparatively, and the international aspects of the game had not started. There were no players from other countries. Today, there are over 100 scattered around different NBA rosters, and there had been stars, obviously, but it was in 1976 when the merger took place between the two leagues. Julius Erving arrived.
Dr. J.
With his magnificent collection of basketball gifts. And then in 1979-80, here came Magic Johnson. It was right in that period that Larry Bird arrived in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1984, that was the draft that brought Michael Jordan into the league. And suddenly you've got this whole collection of not just great players, but colorful, flamboyant players. And the game began to really emerge. It began to take off. It began to gain the ground internationally. Then in 1992, the Olympics allowed the pro players to play, and the Dream Team came along.
Mm-hmm.
And that further elevated the sport. Another great player that we drafted in Philadelphia was Charles Barkley. To add to that collection of colorful and unusually gifted players, so now we had a whole league full of those kind of guys. And the sport began to take off. Television ratings skyrocketed. The game began to be followed internationally, on television particularly. The players in other countries began to develop enormous level of skill, and they moved, transitioned into the NBA. So now you had even more of an international flavor, and that's where we stand today. The league is obviously, the pandemic has been very, very difficult, but the NBA is healthy overall. And once we get through the pandemic, it'll pick up the same pace of growth. And the young talent keeps coming in waves. And I don't see any end to that.
When you look back at those early years before this big swell of personalities and players and all the success that you've mentioned that they enjoyed internationally, what would have been like the expectations for a good year back then in terms of fan support? Would they have anywhere near capacity of what we see today or what, well, at least pre-COVID days back in that time? What was that like?
Well, in many cases, we struggled to draw people in Philadelphia. I know the Celtics always had trouble, even with their good teams. But now, when things are good, you know, many of these franchises are playing to full houses every night.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has added to that are these magnificent arenas that every team in the league has. The Magic's building, the Amway Center, is probably among the finest buildings in the world. For indoor sports, and that is pretty much the case around the country. Everybody has basically a fairly new building or a brand new building, and thus that has a huge effect on attendance as well. The NBA is healthy. Adam Silver is a marvelous leader, excellent commissioner, and I'm excited to. I'm a fan. Even though I left the Magic a little less than 2 years ago to head up this effort to bring Major League Baseball to Orlando, but I'm still a big fan and follow the league very closely.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, when you look back, Pat, what would be, in your mind, one of the fondest memories that you had in anticipating this potential of bringing a team to Central Florida, to Orlando? What was the driving factor for you to start looking that and doing all of the hard work? Because I'm sure that was a lot of legwork for you to do.
I had met a businessman from Orlando some years prior to 1986. His name was Jimmy Hewitt. And Jimmy, an outstanding business leader, strong Christian. He was a risk taker, and he convinced me that I should leave Philadelphia, leave the 76ers, and come down here and try and head up an effort to bring an NBA expansion team to Orlando.
Mm.
Jimmy could sell. He sold me.
Mm-hmm.
And in June of 1986, I left the Sixers after the playoffs and came down here to head up that effort. What I didn't realize back then, Orlando, back in those days, was not that big a city.
Mm-hmm.
There was no skyline. The airport was a dump. No big convention center. No Universal Studios. No Animal Kingdom. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm trying to help head up this baseball dream. Fortunately, the community bought in.
Mm-hmm.
They bought in early, and we had a good presentation we could share with the NBA, and other cities were trying to get in as well. It was quite a period of time in that whole area from 86 to 89, and eventually the league agreed to take all four expansion candidates: Miami, Orlando, Charlotte, and Minnesota, and we all came in, and we had our team.
Mm-hmm.
In late April of 1987, it was announced.
So it sounds like
a big moment for Central Florida.
It certainly was.
A big moment for Orlando, becoming a major league sports city, and it was a big part, I think, of the growth of this area.
Now, it sounds like you would have flown into Orlando prior to OIA being developed, so you would have flown into McCoy Field, right?
Oh, that would be right. And I kept wondering, oh boy, you know, you came off the plane and you walked on wooden sidewalks, and it was not much to look at. And today, Orlando is the busiest airport in Florida, one of the busiest in the country, and rapidly becoming a worldwide mm-hmm. airport. So it's amazing what has happened over these years.
You know, we moved into Orlando ourselves in 1985, so this would have been just about the same time as what you're talking about. And you're right, the downtown skyline has changed drastically, as have the highways that go in and around with all of the different twisting turns and off-ramps that's now down in the downtown area. It looks completely different than what it did when you were first arriving into town.
Hard to recognize or compared to what we had 35 years ago. We had Disney, we had Epcot, but Jimmy Hewitt had sold me on the idea that the best pitch to the NBA back then was not current, but you've got to look down the road. You've got to envision what this place is going to look like in 10 years or 20 years. Now it's 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy was right on that. You know, he said, you've got to sell the future. Well, the future is rather spectacular. When you think about it, there's no end in sight about the growth of this area. It continues. It's very exciting. If you like growth, this is the place to be.
I'm telling you what, Pat, those of us that have been around Orlando, even back in the 80s, would all feel like we would have been greatly benefited by you if you had been on the Traffic Planning Commission. We needed your leadership in the traffic, because what's happening on I-4 right now is about 35 or 40 years, maybe later than what it should have been back then. But it's been a town of growing pains, traffic-wise. But boy, the vision that you're talking about is accurate. You saw it, and that it's just so great. You worked hard then for basically a good 2 years. How long after you got here in 86 did you get the green light from the NBA?
Well, it was actually 10 months. It ended up happening very fast. If we had not been on the timeline we were on, we'd have been too late.
Mm.
And because in April or June of 86, we started the effort. And in April of 87, the NBA made their decision. Well, if my math is right, that's 10 months.
Wow.
And so if we had been a little bit slower in starting, it probably would have been too late.
Mm.
They say that timing is everything. Well, in this case, it certainly was. We had an arena that had to get built on time.
Mm-hmm.
And everything hinged on, just a few little things here and there. If they'd gone the other way, we wouldn't have a franchise. But they broke correctly for us. And I think the Lord was in charge of the whole thing, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of a God thing that we even got it started. I know it was God was in the middle of it, you know, making it all come true. The odds of winning those lotteries, I think God, well, there's a verse in Proverbs that says, man rolls the dice, God determines the outcome.
Hmm.
So I those draft lotteries, as far as I'm concerned, you know, they're like rolling dice, and then God determines the outcome. So he blessed us in that period in an extraordinary way.
2 years in a row of getting the grand prize. That's truly amazing and unprecedented. I don't think it's ever happened since or ever had happened before.
No, it was, let's just put it this way. It was extraordinarily, well, I call it the lottery miracle, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very fortunate. That's how Shaq got here. It's how Penny Hardaway got here. We already had drafted Dennis Scott and Nick Anderson. Horace Grant came in free agency, and that gave us a contending team rather quickly.
My son and I loved watching all of those players that you've mentioned. Reggie Theus was an exciting player and such a nice guy. And one of the things, Pat, just to let you know that I had so much fun with back in that day was The practice facility that you used was a gym in the downtown area, and they would open that up. So the fans got to go down if they wanted to, and we did, and watch the team practice. The players would actually come up and sit by the fans, and I got to hang up there with Reggie Theus back in the day. It's just what an incredible thing, and I got to believe that those players really liked just how much love they were.
Well, there's no question. This was the first major league franchise in the history of Orlando, and those 12 players came.
Yeah, this was really an amazing time frame. And one question before we switch gears on that: when you look back now at those earliest years in Orlando and the players that we had, is there any one memory that you have, Pat, that really sticks out to you as a fondness and a really incredible thing that happened with one of the players or anything like that?
Well, it would have to be the start of our first season. 1989-90 was our first season. We had our team now, and we'd had all these years of excitement building up to the franchise, and suddenly we're a real team. We played the world champion Detroit Pistons in the first preseason game at our brand new arena, and darn if we didn't beat them.
Yes.
We had a full house, hysterical crowd. They thought it was the NBA Finals to the Pistons. It was just another exhibition game. But we prevailed, and our fan base was out of their minds with excitement. They went out into the streets blowing their horns and carrying on like we had just won the whole shebang. Uh-huh. And it was a meaningless exhibition game. But not to us. To us, it was a huge event. And boy, that was probably the most memorable moment to after all the work we'd done and all the preparation, we finally had a game, a real game, real uniforms, real players. And the world champion Pistons came in and we beat them. That was quite a night.
I got to watch that one. I was watching that one from television, but I was thrilled along with two of my children to be able to be at the very first official game. Game number one, I still have my porcelain ticket that was given out to everybody that went there. And wow, what a great night that was. That was an amazing thing as well. So again, there's so many memories, so wonderful to have this fun time. And it was like basketball was at a very zenith of its history during that time frame, getting to see the players that you've mentioned, plus like the visiting teams that would come in with Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing and all of these other great players that played in the NBA. What a wonderful time. And Pat, again, just thank you for your efforts to make Orlando a major league team with basketball, the NBA. So great. And I'm so excited about the potential for the future for baseball. I know that's really in your heart and you would love that. When you look right now, Pat, at Orlando and all the things that have gone on with this past couple of years, with the coronavirus, with all the things that's happened here, what would be, from your standpoint in Central Florida, what would be, first of all, maybe some of the concerning things, and then what are some of the positive things, things that you're most excited about?
Well, Mike, the biggest concern is getting our tourist base back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything that's built here comes through that resort tax. The Phillips Center and the arena and the football stadium and all of that depends really on tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, tourism has taken a huge hit over the last year or so, but it's starting to come back, and it will come back, and I think it'll come back even stronger. Year before last, we had 78 million visitors come here from all over the world, number one tourist destination in the world. And that number, I think over the next 8 or 10 years, probably will get to 100 million.
Mm.
It's an exciting place to live. Now, as far as the sports world, we do have Major League Soccer now. We've got the NBA, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced that this community is ready to be a Major League Baseball city. We're monitoring it very closely. Can we move a team here? Baseball does want to expand eventually by two cities. So we're staying on top of all of this very closely. And I'm convinced that this can be an outstanding Major League Baseball city. It can be not just a good one, but a great one. So stay tuned, folks. We're working hard on it.
Well, anyone who knows you and knows the story of the Orlando Magic would know that there's at least a really good chance that you have the ability to pull this and make this thing happen. And so that's wonderful. We've got about 5 minutes left here, Pat. If you would, I know you've got some a baseball game that you're going to be heading out for in just a little bit, but if you could tell us a little bit about leadership. I know you recently spoke at First Baptist Orlando on the role of leaders and on the need for leaders. We live in a day, don't we, where we need men to step up to the plate and lead like never before.
Mike, all I can tell you is that everything rises and falls on leadership. Every aspect of life. It's always been that way, really, and it always will be that way. And so we need men and women prepared to lead our future, lead in government, lead in business, lead in education, lead in the church, lead in athletics. We need leaders at every level. And so I'm convinced that leadership revolves around seven components to be a great leader. And I'm going to share it with you in a little poem, but I think this is what every leader really needs to be working on. Seven things one must do to be a leader, right and true. Have vision that is strong and clear. Communicate so they can hear. Have people skills based in love and character that's far above, the competence to solve and teach, and boldness that has fearless reach. A serving heart that stands close by to help, assist, and edify. So, Mike, I think those are the foundational pieces of leadership: vision, communicating your vision, people skills, character counts, competence, boldness, and a serving heart. And a leader that has those seven qualities is going to be outstanding no matter what field they're leading in.
That is tremendous. And thank you for speaking with us here today, Pat, and taking the time to be with our listeners here on The Shepherd. We pray for you. I'm still reeling at the fact that you've told me that you're nearing 81 years old. I would never have guessed that. That's just commendable. And friends, that gives us all faith and see if we can get there and hustle and maybe have a bunch of people be just like Pat Williams, and who is a leader extraordinaire and a man who loves the Lord with all of his heart and has for all of these many years. Pat, thank you for being with us.
Mike, thanks a million. God bless. And go up to, by the way, go up to our baseball website, OrlandoDreamers.com.
OrlandoDreamers.com.
Check in and let us hear from you.
That sounds great. We will do that. And thank you again, Pat, for being with me here on Afternoons with Mike.
Take care, Mike. All the best. Bye-bye.
Back again, so appreciative of Pat Williams being with us today on the program. Time to introduce my next guest. I'm so excited about this one. I learned about Marilyn Donnellan from a friend that is now mutual to Marilyn and myself, and that's Suzanne Cheeseman, who's been a guest on my show as well. And Suzanne, of course, works with authors, and Marilyn is an author. And when I say Marilyn is an author, that's a bit of an understatement. She's written over 60 books and pamphlets, and you're a busy lady. How did you do that? Welcome to the program, Marilyn.
Thank you, Mike. It's a delight to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, it's just crazy for me to think about someone being
and we'll be back with Marilyn Donnellan coming up in a moment here on Afternoons with Mike.
That how much time on a given week do you spend or devote to writing just in general?
It kind of depends on what project I'm working on, but generally I'll spend anywhere from 4 to 6 hours a day writing. But it's the proofreading and the follow-up publication that takes the most time, but I thoroughly enjoy the writing side of it.
Well, that's not a surprise to me because I've had talks with people like J.C. Derrick at Main Street Daily News, who is a publisher of our sister publication, a digital newspaper up there. And, you know, when you talk to people who write a lot, it is in the hours per day. And they do that the way a lot of people watch television or spend screen time on the phone. That's what you guys are doing to write that much. Now, I love to write, but I'm not spending the kind of time that you're doing it. And as a result, I don't have 60 books to show for either. So congratulations on just
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you come to know the Lord in the beginning? Where did you grow up? All of those kinds of details.
I actually grew up on a farm in eastern Oregon. We were very poor. There were 6 of us in a 1-bedroom house.
Wow.
And the one thing is, even though we were poor, we never went hungry because being on a farm, of course, we had lots of produce and animals. And so we didn't realize we were poor. But then my dad received a call to the ministry when he was 45. So he sold the farm and we moved to Portland, Oregon, where he attended Multnomah School of the Bible, which is now Multnomah University. He had come to know Christ, as had the rest of our family, during some evangelistic services that were held in our small rural community. So I can recall very vividly every time the evangelist would give the invitation for people to come forward, I was so convinced, I was such a terrible person, I was 9 years old, that I would go down to the front every night and ask God to save me and for Jesus to come into my life. And finally, a counselor said to me, "You know, Marilyn, Jesus died once for you. You don't have to keep asking him to be your savior. He now lives inside you." And I've never forgotten that.
What an impact something like truth makes on that, right?
Yes,
oh, my
absolutely.
Goodness. Oh, that's great. And your dad, you know, when you think about your dad serving there in Oregon and, you know, what we hear coming out of Oregon in the news these days, how does that make you feel to realize that Oregon, which is such a beautiful area, and yet now it is becoming equally known, if not more so, for progressive thought and progressive ideas? How does a person from that area process all that?
It is really sad to see. Those of us who grew up in that beautiful state know that the majority of the people who live across the state are typical rural, very committed to family values. And it's people who have come in from outside the state who are espousing all of these extremely liberal views.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated from high school and college in Portland, and it is just so sad to see that beautiful city torn apart by such evil. It's just tragic.
Well, the things that happened last year in Portland with the siege and the blocking off
yes.
of the downtown area, my daughter lived out there for a couple of years, so I've taken a couple of trips out there. And when you talk about Oregon and particularly Portland being beautiful, that is truly an understatement. When you look at the surroundings, I mean, just the ability, I will never forget, Marilyn, driving down a highway and looking off in the distance and seeing those beautiful mountain peaks.
Yes.
Mount Hood from a, oh my goodness, it's one of the most gorgeous scenes I think I've ever seen in the U.S. It's just beautiful.
It is. And I live in Florida now, but if I don't get back there and get my mountain fix once in a while, I'm a basket case.
It's truly beautiful, but, and as you said, truly sad to realize, and I'm not surprised at all to hear you say that from your perspective, the good people that live in that state by and large are not what we hear represented. Although the news media would like for us to believe that that is the majority view and progressive thought to the degree of anti-police and defund police and all of that, that would just not be representative of the truth and the character of the people that live out there, right?
Absolutely correct. In fact, one of the series of fiction books that I wrote called The Book Liberators actually takes a page from our current history and projects it to 100 years from now, that if this kind of woke behavior continues, what happens to the United States?
Mm-hmm.
So the series is called The Book Liberators, and it was very healing for me to go through and write that series of four books, because I was able to put on paper a lot of the hurt and confusion, and to feel comforted from God to know he's in control and he ultimately will have the final say.
You know, I love getting to talk to people who are authors like yourself, because I do believe that you have this ability. Anyone that, first of all, loves stories must love authors, because they're the ones who give us so many of them. And just the imagination that goes through, I just find it very interesting to talk to people who's able to take those thoughts and then put them down in paper the way you're describing right there, and yet mix a little bit of reality. You talk about fiction now. I'd like to just pause for a moment, because my brain's going out all I'm excited about this. I get this this thought about, how do you separate, when you're writing a fiction book, how do you separate keeping the story in a fiction mode? It's not meaning a true story, but it's often based on true stories. How do you approach that, Marilyn?
Well, I'm very blessed to have had a journalism background, and I have the spiritual gift of exhortation. So I feel very strongly, Mike, that my writing is a gift from God, and I have a responsibility to use that. And when I get a storyline in my head, like the fiction work that I've done, it is really just awesome to just watch the Holy Spirit guide my writing, send me in different directions. And one of the things, this sounds really weird, but that makes it so interesting nowadays compared to even 20 years ago writing, is the searches that you can do on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at one point in the book, I'm thinking 100 years down the road, I'm wondering, what would a refrigerator be like? So I started doing a search on the internet for futuristic refrigerators. And they talk about what's called a gel refrigerator, that you just simply take a carton of milk and shove it into the gel, and it turns it to the right temperature and holds it for you. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. You know, when I think back to what research I did in high school, this is going to date me, friends, but we would go to the library, and Marilyn, I'm sure you've done this for some of your early books as well, and you go to the card file. You remember doing research at the card file, and people today are going, what's a card file? What in the world?
Yes.
But boy, I tell you what, it is a lot different. So when you get an idea, and you said it just kind of rolls around in your head, and you realize that's probably an indication that I need to do something. I need to write something on these ideas, right?
Yes. In fact, I keep a pad and pencil by my bed, because once those thoughts start whirling around in my head, if I don't write them down, I can't sleep because I'm writing the book in my head.
Wow.
So it helps to write it down, and I will take that little gem of an idea and then start adding character traits, descriptions. The book Liberator's Book, the third one in the series called The Mother Warrior, is actually set in the Portland area on the Columbia River.
It's really exciting to see an author use their areas. Dan Walsh, a good friend of mine over in Daytona Beach, has written many books, and he actually used his own area. And it's really great because then you can write with a real sense of the area and include details that anybody at all that picks that book up that might have spent time in the Portland area or Oregon, they're going to really identify with that, don't they?
Correct. And I have been blessed to work and travel all across the United States. So it makes it really easy to add those kinds of geographical facts to the book. And in fact, for my nonfiction, like my newest book, The 10 Keys to Effective Leadership, a guidebook for women of faith, that one also is based on those years of experience across the United States while working in and serving in ministry.
Now, while we talk about that in a moment, I've got one quick question. Which of the two genres, fiction or nonfiction, do you really love the most and why?
Well, I think probably while I love fiction, I really have to work hard at it because I'm not a Stephen King. I'm not a C.S. Lewis. So my writing, because of my journalism background, has a tendency to be very short and direct and to the point. And that's what I need when I'm writing nonfiction. When I'm writing the books on leadership or nonprofit management, it is much better to avoid all the theory and detail and just cut right to the chase on what works and what doesn't work. So while fiction is much more challenging for me and I enjoy it, I would have to say that probably writing the nonfiction books, like the book on church management, are much easier. And that's why the majority of my books are nonfiction.
Now, you said your latest book is called 10 Keys to Effective Leadership. How did you come about getting this idea? What was driving this in your mind?
Well, it's actually interesting, Mike. I was at a writer's conference and I met with an agent and she suggested to me that I write a book on leadership because she said with my more than 35 years of experience as a leader and a woman of faith, that there's a real dearth of good writing on that topic. So that was, I kind of regarded that as a voice from God telling me that I needed to do it. And it was very helpful. I happened to be a student of the Bible, a graduate of Multnomah myself, as well as Atlantic Coast Theological Seminary. So I wanted to write the book from a biblical standpoint, but to address very candidly the issues that I've had to deal with in leadership and the difficulty I've had actually ministering in local churches because I have such strong leadership gifts. So God instead pulled me into the nonprofit sector, and that's where my ministry has been.
What do you see as the top couple of keys that particularly women who are in roles of leadership need to heed?
The number one is learning. And I actually use the word leadership to spell out the 10 keys. And the first one is L for learning. If we as individuals, man or woman, don't concentrate on learning and filling the gaps in our knowledge and understanding, we will stagnate. So learning for women and men in leadership is absolutely essential, that we never get to the point to where we think we know it all.
This acronym type of a format that you're covering then, I'm just looking down and realizing that you said the 10 keys. So each one of your chapters might be lining up to the letters and the kind of the acrostic of leadership, right?
That's correct. Learning, excellence, appreciation, decisive decisions, engagement with others, relieve stress, spiritual gifts, have a thick skin.
Now, let's talk about that one for a moment. Let's hang on. Let's hang on that age for a second. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that particularly as women, and Mike, I'm sure even as a man, you can relate to this, that if we're doing God's work and we are in ministry, Satan's going to do his best to interfere with our ability to have an impact. And I have had my share of criticism and negativity. I remember early on in leadership, I would have a man call and I would ask if I could help him. And he would say, "I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to a man."
Mm-hmm.
That kind of hurtful thing, we have to get over. I cannot control what other people think or feel, but I can use the grace of God to be gentle and respond in love in spite of the criticism. So when I say have a thick skin, it means learning how to forgive and to keep doing what you know God has called you to do.
That's wonderful. And this sounds like such an effective and very practical book. And it is called 10 Keys to Effective Leadership. How can people check more out about you? What's your website, Marilyn?
www.mldonellen.com. And Donellan is spelled D-O-N-N-E-L-L-A-N. Or you can go to my author's page at amazon.com/author/MLDonellan.
Oh, can't wait to find out more about this and look up some of the amazing amount of publications that this lady has put out for us. Thank you for being with us today on the program and for sharing some of your story. And we're so glad to have you in the fine sunshine state of Florida now, which is kind of polar opposite in the United States to where you were from before. But we're glad to have you here, Marilyn. And thanks for being on my program.
Thank you, Mike.
And a big thank you to Pat as well. That's all my time. I'll catch you next time right here on The Shepherd.